you shouldn't neglect your product. And if you do neglect your product, you'll probably experience some churn, or you'll experience some things that you don't want to experience, like with your customer base. Right. And customer success is also a very, like, don't just sell people and forget about them.
Right.
Be friends with your customers, because then they'll tell you what you want them to tell you about, you know, their true thoughts and opinions about the product.
Logan, thanks for being here, my friend.
Yeah, absolutely. Is my mic set up okay?
Yeah, dude, you're good. Yeah, bring it. Right. Yep, yeah, bring it right up here. You can move it around.
Sweet.
Get comfortable. Yeah, man.
All right.
So localize. We were talking a little bit about that before this, but I think one of the story that I wanted to kind of get out of you, boss, was you're a young founder.
Yes.
And I mean, we've all been there, I think. What's your experience been like? As a young founder, like trying to come up and I don't know what your background is. Did you go to college or anything?
I did.
Okay.
I didn't finish.
That's fair.
I went for a while.
That's fair. So I'm probably, you probably hit quite a bit of hurdles with like being young.
Yeah.
And that, so tell us your experience, man. Tell us what it's like.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a lot of like drawbacks to being young. I actually posted something on LinkedIn a while ago, which, by the way, my LinkedIn is like half legit and half trolling. Yeah. So if anyone, like if you look at my LinkedIn, there's some stuff, just don't pass judgments on me because my LinkedIn. So anyways, I posted something. I posted a poll. I think I was like, what do you guys think? I feel like I deal with a little bit of ageism. Do you guys feel like it's more advantageous, more or less advantageous to be a young founder? And it was like 50-50, but I think it's more advantageous, because where you deal with some ageism, some people that are like, are you supposed to be in this room? Kind of a, you know, just, you get that sort of feeling from some people. But on the other side of things, there's a bunch of people that really know what they're talking about, and they're great, like mentors or even investors or whatever. And they just want to help you because you're young. So you get like, when you're young, like when you're in your 20s and your 30s, that's like a great time to capitalize on people's willingness to like mentor you and help you. Cause like, when you're like 50, you probably want to be like teaching some young guns how to get it done. It's like,
you have some people behind you. Yeah.
It's a gratifying. You might not have an incentive to do it other than it just feels good. Yeah. It's like, you know, purposeful. So anyways,
how do you balance the conversation? I didn't mean to interrupt.
No, you're good.
Okay. How do you balance the conversation of, like showing you have the confidence and the skills and the knowledge, and like, also I need your help. I need to know what to do in this situation. Like, how do you balance that conversation with maybe someone older, like maybe an investor or whatever?
That's a good question. So I was just on the phone yesterday. Do you know Darren Hill from Rev Road?
Yes.
Familiar with Rev Road?
Yeah.
So Darren is the founder of Rev Road. And like, if you don't know Darren, Darren's the real deal, like had some big exits and he knows his stuff. Mm-hmm. So we're a Rev Road portfolio company. But also he's, our largest investor. And so, I was on the phone with him, and like he had taken a sales meeting with me. So we had that sales meeting, and he called me after and gave me a lot of advice and like gave me some feedback on kind of how I handled the sales meeting and just multiple points of feedback. Whenever Darren says something, I'd like nod my head and like write it down. Cause
I mean,
he's the real deal and I trust him. But on the other side of things, like he, you know, even though he's a very good mentor to us and he's closely involved with our business, he's an investor. He is, you know, Rev Road also is a shareholder. So through Rev Road, he's affiliated with us as well. And he has a lot of skin in the game. He doesn't take over. Like, he shows all the time that he trusts us. Like, when we've made pivots in the past, he's basically said, if this is what you think, then you got to do it. So I think you got to be coachable and be humble, but also like good mentors are going to show you that they're mentoring you because they have some level of confidence.
I see.
So it's kind of like, you know, take that confidence and actually make, you know, make something out of it.
So you're kind of saying you're kind of talking about like when you're younger like this, you want to really focus on finding the right people to have in your corner.
Yeah.
The people who can trust you and also like give you the rope, but also like, hey, I think this is what you should do.
Right. It's yeah, like, I don't know what it was like for you, mm-hmm. but I know there were times where there are certain things that I would do when I was younger and my dad would be over my shoulder. And it was like, I did not know what I was doing. He'd kind of take over and like do it for me.
Yeah.
But then I, you know, as you get a little bit older, your parents, your dad, mom, whoever it is, older sibling, you're less controlled by other people and yeah. people kind of give you the freedom to do what you want. It's kind of like the idea that you get a driver's license. You like get a lot of freedom. So I turned 16, got my driver's license. All of a sudden I can like go wherever I want. I can take girls out. I can like do all this stuff. So you have to have this certain level of freedom or otherwise it's not a mentorship relationship. So it's like you're driving the car. A mentor should not be driving the car. You're driving the car. But I mean, if they're, you know, you can have them in the passenger seat. They can help you.
They can give you the map or whatever. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. They can tell you about the times that they crashed the car and not to do things the way that they, you know.
It's hard for somebody to do that. You know, it's hard for, because like I've since like, you know, I have, there's that method that's like, you know, you have someone that you're teaching, someone who's on the same level as you and someone that's mentoring you. Like those are the three kind of relationships you'd have in life. Like someone behind you, someone on you, someone in front of you.
Right.
Right. And I think what's interesting, the hardest part for me is like realizing, and I had this conversation, like when I became a parent, like somebody asked me what the hardest thing about becoming a parent was. And it was the idea that like, it's so hard to let go of like the reins.
Yeah.
It's so hard. Dude.
I can
like,
see that.
Like when you're a coach, right? Like you guys played sports. We all played sports. Like you play sports.
Yeah.
So it's like when your coach or when coaches would say and stuff, they would go like, I can't go out on the field with you. Right. And it's not like, and we used to be like, yeah, whatever. Okay. But I learned like that it was like, not because they can't go on the field. It's not because they don't want to, or they like aren't able to, but it's because they literally can't go on the field. Like it doesn't do anything.
Right.
And I think that's probably the hardest lesson I had to learn. And so when I gained the most empathy for people, I used to like, we all hate micromanagers, you know, but I gained a lot of empathy because I'm like, damn, that's really hard. Not for me to just tell my daughter everything that she needs to do.
Right? It's seriously hard. Like we're building out our sales development team mm-hmm. right now. And so we're, you know, hiring reps and like some of our, I'm thinking of one or two of our reps that are newer to it. And I've noticed that it's easier and it's more comfortable for me to just sit down one-on-one with them and do things the way that I would do them to kind of show them like, hey, this is, if I was making this call, I would say this. And I always thought that was a good thing because it was like, mm-hmm. you know, I have a little bit of experience here and this is how I would do it. Hopefully that's going to help them. What I realized is it's not as helpful. I mean, it can be.
Yeah.
But for me to just show you and just do something and you watch and be like, okay, did we learn? It's like, yeah. It's not actually that, right. Not that good. If I go into our like dialer software and listen back to their calls and break down their calls with them and pause it and say, okay, at this part, what do you think you could have done to change this call? Way more effective. Like people listen to themselves. They can recognize their own mistakes and most of the time self-correct, or even if you need to give them a little bit of a nudge in the right direction, and make some suggestions. That's way more useful. It's like if you've ever watched a YouTube video of something and you're like, oh yeah, that looks easy. I can totally do it. And then you try it and you like go straight back to the YouTube video. Cause you're like, wait, I'm totally doing it wrong. Like, have you ever surfed?
Yeah.
So first time surfing, probably I would imagine you're like, you know, it looks pretty easy and you get on the board and like you're like ready to kind of get your feet up and stand up on the board. And unless you're like amazing, usually you just like botch it on your first couple of times. Like get up on the board and you're like, it looks so easy in the videos. It's way, way, way more productive to try to get up on a surfboard and fall and figure out, oh, I was too far forward on the board. I was too far back on the board. So you feel it and you can like tell when you did something wrong. Right. But if someone else just like shows you, okay, you suck at surfing, so just watch me do it a couple of times. It's like, it doesn't really help. It's like, I've seen people surf before. I still can't do it.
Yeah.
And I'm bad at surfing. I'm not good at surfing. It's like, I could watch a pro surfer all day long and I won't get any better at surfing.
Right.
I
have to go and
surf.
So. You got to like work it out. Yeah. Well, what's funny is like I wrestled and that was a lot of, for me is like, you'd see a wrestler and they do a move and you'd be like, oh yeah, I can do that. Hey, let me try this. And then when you try the move that you saw on TV, you're like, this is a lot harder. Seriously. Like, what did he do with his hand? Cause you missed the nuances of like all the steps that it took to get there. So dude, how did you get into Localize? Like, how did it start?
So, I was like almost an accidental entrepreneur kind of.
Love it.
One thing that's kind of weird, or just, maybe a little abnormal is, my role in the company is primarily over sales related things like product marketing and sales are what I focus on the most. Mm-hmm. And sales is kind of my core competency. So most people that are an entrepreneur and that's kind of their wheelhouse will tell you about how they were like hustling in elementary school and like slinging candy to their classmates and making money. Not me. Like, I was a shy kid. If you would have asked me when I was like 13, if I would want to do a job where I'm constantly getting like rejected by people and selling to people and like doing, I would have been just like terrified because I could barely, you know, hold my own in a social situation. So now I just, you know, I kind of over the course of like high school got a little more, just, I don't know, a little more socially confident, but then, confidence in entrepreneurship is a totally different thing because you realize that like there's, how do I explain this? So, you know, when someone is really good at something in high school and then they go to college and they realize that they, relative to the other people that are good at that, are not very good.
Yeah.
It's like you go to a bigger pond.
Yeah.
Entrepreneurship is like, it seems like it shouldn't actually be that hard. Cause you're like, oh, all I got to do is have a good idea. Because you see, like, and you see big companies, you're like,
oh, If I build it, they will come.
If I would have had the idea for Airbnb, oh, I'd be a billionaire. Maybe if you were as good an entrepreneur as, like, it's really under, like, people don't understand that entrepreneurship is way more about the process than the idea.
Yeah.
So, anyways, this is a long-winded way to say that I had an idea with a couple of friends in 2020. And we wanted to kind of flesh it out and try it. So we went around talking to people. The idea was that if we created a free concierge system for hotels and Airbnbs that would show guests, you know, local restaurants and attractions, that if it was free, we could spread it like wildfire and then monetize it by promoting restaurants and attractions. So we went around like Park City, just talking to people, saying like, would you participate in this? Would you pay to be featured on this list? Would you want this in your Airbnb, et cetera? And I was pumped about it. I was like, okay, people are really going for this. I like this. And everyone else was like excited, but maybe not ready to like give up their commitments for it. So I was at the time selling replacement windows.
Okay. Yeah.
And like the next day I just like texted my boss. I was like, hey, I'm sorry. I think I'm donezo. Do my 2 weeks if you want, but I'm going to try something else. And he was like, okay. And no one else really wanted to pursue it with me. So I just started it at first by myself and very quickly brought in a co-founder. And then we just, you know, started figuring things out and
started selling.
Well, not quite selling at the beginning. We didn't monetize for like a year, but we raised like $50,000 from family and friends. So we could fund a couple of ideas, and our ideas were like, we wanted to create these QR code displays that people would put in their Airbnbs and everything. Yeah. And so we've like, you know, made some orders of those. This is a good story, actually. So we thought that Park City was going to be our home run.
Yeah.
And it's funny now because actually most of our customers with our new product that I haven't really dug into.
Yeah.
Most of our customers for our new product, which is an AI driven product, are in Park City. So it's come full circle now.
Yeah.
We're signing up properties in Park City. But at the time, we marched into Park City with this QR code display and we're like, this is going to spread like wildfire. And no one really went for it. That guy, yeah, that guy I told you about, Elizabeth Smart's husband,
yeah,
totally rejected me. He was like, this is not solve any problems for me. Didn't want it.
Whoa, dang, man.
Well, honestly, I'm glad that you said that kind of stuff because he kind of showed me what it's like to be an entrepreneur and just talk to someone who is blunt with you and honest about what they think of your product. And I was like,
yeah, no.
Take that one on the chin, I guess.
Well, you don't realize how, what's the word I'm looking for? Like, you don't realize how valuable that feedback is. Like, yeah, it kind of sucks. You know what I mean? Like, especially if someone doesn't deliver it with like empathy, if they're just like, get the hell out of my face. Yeah. What is this? Because
sometimes if they deliver it with empathy, you almost think that they're like, maybe they like it or like, like it if it was a little different. The truth is like, it's very valuable when someone just says, look, I do not.
Like, I don't have time for this. I don't have time for this. And it sucks.
Right. Exactly. The important thing is just to ask why, like, why don't you like it? And if people are like, ultimately, it just doesn't solve any problems for me, then like, that's something you got to take back to the drawing board. I mean, if it's one person, then maybe not. Because not every person has the same problems.
Right.
But if you're consistently just finding that people, that you're not solving problems for people, the problem is your product.
Yeah.
But, anyways, so we like got, you know, we were banging our heads against the wall for probably not 9 months, like 6-7 months. And I think we had about 200 Airbnbs or like hotel rooms that we had partnered with by maybe August of 2021.
Yeah.
And so not really enough that we didn't want to monetize it until we felt like it was closer to its peak.
Yeah.
So then we decided that we were just going to open it up to Salt Lake and Provo and see what happened. And I was thinking like, there's not even that many Airbnbs in Salt Lake and Provo.
Oh, wow.
I was wrong.
Yeah.
I was very wrong.
Good God. So, yeah. There's a lot.
Yeah. There are a lot. And they keep every year there's more. But anyways, so I met a guy named Aaron Kirkham who runs.
Yeah.
Are you familiar
with that? Holy crap. Why do I know Aaron Kirkham? Where does he
work? So he runs, so he has a company called Comigo Vacation Rentals.
Uh-huh.
And he runs a Facebook group of Airbnb hosts.
Okay.
And he runs actually lots of groups. And so he has a very large network of hosts.
Yeah.
But his biggest group, I think, is Utah or maybe Florida. But Utah's up there. So I met him because I posted in his Facebook group and it was like, hey, Airbnb hosts, if you want this, just sign up and we'll send it to you for free. And he was like, hey, this is kind of cool. Do you want to send me like 60 for my all my vacation rentals? And I was like, yeah. And I was like, I'll totally do that. Do you want to like promote it in your group for me so that it's coming from the admin instead of from me? And he was like, sure. And he did. And we had like 1,200 signups in 3 days.
Good Gandhi.
So we were like, oh my gosh, this is crazy. Like,
you're like your big win. You're like, this is
big. Yeah. And we had so many signups we had to turn down because there was like people in Iowa and people in like California that had heard of it.
Iowa, dude. I'm just kidding.
Yeah. Iowa. Hey, anyone, any of those listeners out there from Iowa, you are not my friend.
You're good, dude,
Did Iowa win in the tournament yesterday? They played yesterday, right? They did win.
The wrestling you're talking about?
In the March Madness.
Oh, I don't know.
Dude, shout out Iowa for winning in March Madness yesterday. I'm sorry I dissed everyone from Iowa. I feel bad now.
Anyways, Iowa won, dude.
Yeah. Go Iowa. No, you guys are great. I'm sorry I didn't give you my QR code displays. Anyways.
Good for you. Go ahead.
So, we had like 1,200 signups in a couple of days. So we were like, oh my gosh, this is crazy. We need to actually get some money so we can fulfill all those orders.
Yeah.
We scraped together the money for it and we fulfilled those orders. And then we had the bright idea. So we actually started monetizing it like right around the end of 2021, beginning of 2022. So for a couple months in 2022, we were making maybe a couple thousand bucks a month of revenue from promoting places like Jurassic Tacos. Like I'm trying to think of the ones that people will know. Have you seen like Bun Boys?
In Provo? Yeah.
It's like Jimmy and Bun Boys. They're like maybe our earliest customer. So we started promoting these restaurants and making a little bit of revenue. And then we decided to, you know, put on our big boy cap and go to Vegas, try it out in Vegas. And that was when we got introduced to hotels, because in Vegas, they don't like vacation rentals.
No, dude, they don't.
Yeah.
Because the hospitality industry is thriving. That's our whole ecosystem.
And they own the government. Like the casinos really have a tight hold on the government. And so there are some restrictions on vacation rentals there that are pretty strict.
That's fair.
Yeah. Well, actually, this is a funny thing.
Good for them, though.
Yeah. I mean,
whatever, dude.
I don't really. It's like, look.
Yeah.
The way I view it, I wish they would do more for the vacation rentals and allow that to happen. It's probably not going to there for a while. But as a traveler, it's like most people are, you know, if they're going to Vegas, they're okay with just staying on the strip.
Well, yeah, I feel like that's the experience, right? Like, right. I don't know if I'd want to stay out in like Summerlin or something.
Right. Yeah, no, I was back and forth in Summerlin because we went to Vegas. We put a team out there of some college students out there, like door to door type of thing. We called it store to store.
Yeah. Okay.
And because I had been down to Vegas a bunch of times meeting with, vacation rental. Well, I was delivering orders for the vacation rental owners, the Airbnb host. So I was delivering orders. So we probably have our displays in like almost every vacation rental in the Vegas area, because there's only like 100 or 200 of them. But that's when we got introduced to hotels, because we were like, okay, if we want to make a real monetizable like platform here, we need to work with hotels.
Yeah.
So we started working with independent hotels. We got a bunch in Vegas. We did, you know, our revenue shot up by about 5 or 6x what it was prior to that, because Vegas is just, it's Vegas. And so we had like 100+ advertisers in Vegas, and that was great. We actually, it's crazy, I was like flying by the seat of my pants the whole time, because we had a team that was going to be driving down to Vegas on like a Monday. And I think the Monday prior to that, I met with someone, and we still didn't have all the partnerships that we wanted to start selling. So we were brainstorming, like, are we going to have them start selling like future subscriptions? Like, hey, this is going to start in, you know,
in
July or whatever. And we'll keep you updated on what properties we sign up. Like, and that's kind of sketchy. So it was like the week prior through basically a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend of a friend. It was like this huge chain of people. Met this girl that worked for this company that in 2020, when all these big casinos were facing cash flow issues, the casinos started selling units. So like the MGM Grand actually sold some of their rooms to third parties. And this one company. Whoa,
that's crazy.
Yeah. So there's like 300 rooms in the MGM Grand that no longer belong to MGM. They belong.
That's trippy, dude.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
That's weird, man. So they sold the room like an apartment, like $300,000 for this room.
Yep. And you can book it on Airbnb. So like you can book a room in the MGM Grand on Airbnb, or
if somebody bought it.
Yeah. And they don't have any incentive to. So this is what happened. It's a company called StripView Suites. And I met this girl that was the marketing director there. And I discovered that they owned like 700 units on the strip. They owned units in the MGM.
Holy shit, dude.
Palms. Yeah.
Wait. Bunch. Oh, you're tripping me out, dude.
Isn't that weird?
The hotel sold the rooms like a condo. Like this room is for sale for $150,000. If you buy it, it's yours. Yeah.
But like to exclusive buyers, I think.
Right. Yeah. Not to anybody. I'm not saying that. But essentially that was the transaction.
Yeah. Isn't that bizarre?
Do they pay like royalties to MGM or anything like that? Or... Or like,
I don't know.
Because if the MGM Grand, like, it would never happen. But in theory, like, if they closed for some reason, you lose that room, right?
So I don't really know. I'm sure there
like
are
the
some
details of the.
Yeah, I'm sure there's some weird things there. But yeah, it's like it was a bizarre, and I wasn't prepared. I didn't know that, and I was hustling around in the hospitality industry in Vegas. I still didn't know that, and most people in Vegas don't even know that. But we partnered with this company, and all of a sudden, because they don't have any incentive to send their guests to the casinos, because they don't get royalties from the casinos, so they were like, this is great for us. We can show them all the cool restaurants and things that are off the strip even, like, you know, and they're like, this is way cool. So we partnered with them, and all of a sudden we were in a bunch of hotels off the strip, a bunch of vacation rentals off the strip, and like Henderson and, you know, like Summerlin and those areas.
Yeah.
And then like 700 or 800 units on the strip.
Wow.
And then we were like, we did it. Like, okay, now we can really target everyone we want to target.
Yeah.
So, then after that, and we made a bunch more money in Vegas than I think we generated like right around 200,000 in annual recurring revenue in Vegas, which for us is a lot, because prior to that,
200K ARR.
Yeah.
Well, dude, that's great.
It was great
for anybody.
Prior to that, we hadn't done more than like, you know, $3,000 revenue in a month.
Yeah.
So then to do that in like 3 months, we were like, this is great. Like, we're going to hit a million so quick.
Yeah.
But our thing was territory, because we're like, okay, now we have all these people in Vegas. So where's our next move? Our next move was Florida. And then when we went to Florida, it was like a little bit of a wake up call. We started calling all these hotels and meeting with these hotels that had kind of, you know, hotels had carried us in Vegas. So that's what we started with in Florida.
Yeah.
And just what we found out was, we needed something like for a hotel in Florida to really change the way that they do things and the way that they recommend that their guests experience Florida, it needed to be a big change. Couldn't just be like, hey, they can scan this thing and like see all these cool restaurants and attractions. 'Cause in Florida, like in Vegas, a lot of people are like, yeah, if they're staying here in Vegas, they're probably expecting to go to the casino. And so this will give a cool competitive edge to the other hotels. In Florida, it's like, you're not going to spend time in your hotel.
Right.
It's like, you're going to Florida because you're going to Disney or you're going to the beach or whatever it is. So they are keenly aware that they need to be offering their guests a concierge service. A lot of them have desks even. And so we were like, all right, we need something that's going to totally change the way they do things and solve some problems for them that aren't really currently being solved.
Yeah.
So we brainstormed and kind of took it to the lab and found out that if we were to incorporate our product into something that was available via text, that it would not only be a better end user experience, but also we would have basically a channel through which we could solve multiple huge problems in the hospitality industry.
Wow, dude, that's crazy.
So yeah, that's like
So this is where you're at now. You got the AI messaging stuff.
So it was kind of cool. Like, we just decided we're going to develop this thing. I actually remember having a conversation with like one of my employees, and I was like, okay, I just drove home from, I don't remember. I went on like a 4-hour road trip, and oftentimes on those road trips, if I'm driving, I'm just in like thinking mode.
Yeah.
And,
you're like no music. You're just like thinking, bro.
Yeah.
Good for you, dude.
Knows those experiences where you drive home from something with no music.
Yeah. That's usually called depression, but I mean,
severely depressed.
That's anxiety, bro.
Yeah. No, that's like what being an entrepreneur is, just like summed up. It's like a lot of depression, a lot of anxiety. And then a couple of moments where you feel like the coolest.
Yeah. And then you're like, what is depression and anxiety?
Yeah. You're like, I've never felt anything bad in my life. And then like your deal falls through and you're like, I'm going to be broke next month and I'm going to have to beg someone for a job. Yeah. No, that's.
But I hear you. All right, keep going.
That's like my thinking, you know, I'll just be in brainstorming. Like, there will be, you know, maybe once a month or once every other month where I'll have like a couple hours where I'm just like, all right, I'm in pure brainstorming mode, nothing but brand new ideas. Mm-hmm. And most of them are a steaming pile of crap. And it's just like, this is not, I'm never going to use this. But I called up one of my employees and I was like, okay, I'm going to spit out a bunch of ideas at you. Tell me what sounds good. We're going to dig into it more. And I was like, okay, I don't even remember what the other ideas were. I had a bunch of ideas as to how we could break into the Florida market. Mm-hmm. And one of the things I said is I was like, okay, text chatbot, localized chatbot, basically, mm-hmm. But via text for hotel guests and Airbnb guests. And he was like, that sounds kind of cool. So started doing research, found some other companies that were doing a similar thing. But we basically discovered that were we the first people to decide that we were going to do an AI texting solution for hotels? No. But there was a severely underserved portion of the market that no one was going after. And it was the same people that we were working with in Vegas and that we were talking to in Florida, which was like independent hotels. Mm-hmm. Non-branded hotels, particularly the ones that are not those monster 700 room resorts.
Yeah.
So like small and mid-sized independents, because what you have in small and mid-sized independent hotels is basically the mom-pa shop of the hospitality industry.
Yeah.
And most people don't know that. They think that every hotel is just like there's some owner and then there's like some manager who makes their six-figure salary. A lot of times it's like you someone bought out a hotel in the 60s and they just still run that thing.
Yeah. A lot of people don't know that like those hotels are franchises either.
Yeah. Yeah. That's
yeah. Like there's quite a few franchise hotels and like this guy's just a franchise operator. Like he's not even the guy. He's not, you know, he's not Marriott.
Right. Exactly. So it's interesting. Like we were working with all these independent hotels and a couple of things about independent hotels, and I don't want to bore you with hospitality facts or anything, but just this is the reason why we realized that we had stumbled on a gold mine.
Yeah.
Because they struggle with things like reviews. And I had someone a couple of days ago tell me that a 5-star review for their hotel is worth $1,000 to them.
Good Gandhi.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, that's crazy.
And so like we do, Marie is what our product is called.
Yeah.
Marie, at the end of every guest stay, Marie asked people how their stay was, and the AI technology can kind of detect, is this person going to leave a 5-star review or something less than that? And then if they're going to, if it's someone who says my stay was great, 5 out of 5, loved it, then Marie will prompt them to leave a Google review or a TripAdvisor review. But anything else, Marie will just connect them with someone on the property to kind of resolve disputes and issues and avoid negative reviews. So
that's huge. Yeah, that's huge.
Very big. There are businesses built on that principle alone. Like
Podium, Weave.
Yeah. And like Ovation. Zach Oates from Ovation. Like he's a friend of mine and they do that for the food and beverage industry. Mm-hmm. And that's their whole thing is guest feedback. And awesome company. They're killing it.
Yeah.
So that was something we discovered. Also, just like when was the last time you stayed at a hotel?
Oh, when I took my wife to Disneyland.
Okay.
Yeah.
Did you get any text messages from your hotel?
No.
So if you needed something from the front desk, what would you have had to do?
Dial 0 or walk to the front desk?
Yeah. Pick up some phone that you probably would not find anywhere else. Like where could you find a phone like the ones they have in hotels today than hotels?
Right.
No one uses them. Like the hospitality industry is severely, severely outdated.
Yeah.
And so but the problem is they're also severely understaffed. So if we say, okay, we're going to text our guests now, what people don't understand is an individual is 3 times more likely to text you as a hotel than they are to call you.
Yeah.
So if they can text, they will in a much higher volume. And all of a sudden you're understaffed and you have all these text messages. And so that's where the AI comes in. It's like you need someone
who can just say whatever.
Yeah. Yeah. Who can just feel those requests and, you know.
Yeah, bro. That's crazy. So much cool stuff. At the end of the day, what made you want to be an entrepreneur? I mean, we were talking before the interview. It was like more than the idea, more than the process. But, you know, you also mentioned you had been like an introvert and things like that.
Yeah.
So like, dude, that's a big jump. That's a big jump to go from, I don't want anybody to know who I am to like localize who we are, taking over the world kind of fit.
And I was never this like super severely introverted guy. Like I was introverted around my close friends and family. Yeah. But I can tell you like I would say most people know what it feels like when you're in like middle school or whatever to just kind of not know what to do or what to say in a lot of situations.
Yeah.
That's definitely how I felt a lot of the time. So I never would have pictured myself wanting to do something like this where you're always, you know, figuring out what to do and what to say on the fly. Because, I mean, I think we all know that is really a lot of entrepreneurship is doing and saying the right thing on the fly.
Yeah. You just got to like, you just pray that it works.
Right. Right. And all right. I want to tell you this. Sorry, I'm getting sidetracked. So you asked why I wanted to be an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
This story is a good reflection of one of the reasons why I love being an entrepreneur. And it was like, I didn't know I wanted to be an entrepreneur, but I got a taste of it. And I was like, I can never go back.
Yeah.
So we started selling this product before. So our minimum viable product that was being developed and it was almost ready while we were selling it, and we sold it and we got contracts signed and we promised features and we had a whole situation blow up and we couldn't use any of the code that we had. And we were and it was like 2 weeks away from, and we were like, oh gosh, dude, this is like disaster scenario. And me and my co-founder, neither of us are software engineers. So we were working with a third party software engineer. This was like a couple of weeks ago.
Oh,
this like wasn't very long ago. This is last month. This was in February. I'm like with my family's in town. My family's from Washington State, but they're all in town. We're all hanging out and I'm like in crisis mode because everyone's like hanging around playing games. And I'm like on the phone with everyone. Like, we need a software developer. We need to find someone who can take a rush order fast and someone that's good and someone who's familiar with AWS and JavaScript and integration, someone who can make a kick-ass Twilio integration and like all these things. So I'm calling people and I called like 8 developers that night and explained the project and was like, can you take it? And eventually I found someone and he's a software developer. He's a like childhood friend of mine and he's a software developer for AWS, but he also did chatbots for Disney for like 5 years.
Oh, wow.
So he was the perfect fit because we host everything through AWS.
Yeah.
And like, he's very, you know, well versed in chatbot technology. So, we started, working with him, you know, he got the job done in a matter of 3 weeks or something. And we were like, dude, you're the best. Like, this is so good. And, so we're in the process of hiring another developer, because he has a full-time job. So burden with everything, but, the thrill of like selling something when you don't know if the product is going to be deliverable is like a crazy adrenaline high.
Like
being in the air on like jump from a ramp or something. Like what that feeling is.
And somebody's listening to this. He's talking about pre-sale orders, which is a very common thing in any industry.
Right.
I know I've had this conversation and I've had people overhear that like used took someone's money and slept at night when you didn't have anything to deliver them. Like, that's not what I'm talking about. Okay. Like,
it's like,
we kind of hold the money in escrow and then once it's delivered, okay. Like, if it doesn't work, we'll give the money back. Stop thinking I'm a sleazeball.
Yeah. Right? Also. Yeah. And the other thing about it too, is like, that's the process of validations. Like, you need people to actually agree,
pay you
to know that you're doing the right thing. So like, don't invest.
Yeah.
And this is a mistake that I'm not some, you know, expert that, you know, I've built a bunch of companies and exited from a bunch of companies or anything, but I do know that there's a lot of people that I've seen even here in Utah that raise a bunch of money and they hire a bunch of developers and they love their product. They're in love with their product, which is good.
Yeah.
And you should be, 100% sold that your product is right for your customers.
Yeah.
But they
build the whole thing, they make all the money and all these freaking never sell it.
Yeah, it's like they've barely had any sales and they're like, we're releasing a new feature. It's like, for who? Who are you releasing the feature for? Who told you to release that feature? One of your 3 customers? Like, and that's not me like,
no, it is though. You can brag on
trash talking anyone.
Go ahead though.
This is just what I've learned is
it's true though, because if you're in that business and you build a sweet, sexy product and no one buys it, that's just as bad as me taking someone's money and never delivering because you didn't do anything.
You're taking investor money and you're using all this time and resources and making, promises to the people that are involved.
Yeah.
And ultimately, no business is going to deliver on its promises if it doesn't have customers.
Right.
So for us, we were like, we'll sell before we develop so that we know what to develop, and then we'll develop it. And then we'll start selling again. Yeah. And that's kind of our cycle is like, we're still in right now. We're working on Marie 1.2, which is just, a small iteration from our original, and all the features that are involved in this iteration, we already knew we wanted, but it was a matter of getting that's a definition of a minimum viable product is get something that's the minimum viable to solve the problems you're trying to solve.
Yeah.
Get some and people to
buy it,
give you their credit card and buy it. And then,
a lot of people don't understand that. And they rag on salespeople for that. But it's like, I just talked to a good friend of mine, Tim Cooley, who created the Pitch Deck book and all this stuff. And he called me because he knows I'm a podcaster. He goes, "Hey, I have this software. This is what it's going to do. How much would you pay me right now if I could do that?" And I was like, "I don't know, 20 or 30 bucks a month." He goes, "Right now, you give me your card." And I go, "Yeah." And he goes, "All right, cool. Then I'm going to call you in 6 weeks and you better have it ready." Right. Like that's just what we do.
That's good.
But that's just what we do. You know what I mean? Like, how much would you pay right now? Like right now. And you get people to commit. And shoot, he almost asked me for my damn card right then.
Yeah.
I was like, "Bro, get the product done." And then call me,
That's good. That is how it should be.
Yeah, you're like, not if it's nice, because dude, if it's nice, but forcing someone to think of a price that they would pay for it really forces them to.
Yes.
It's like, also, that's why I didn't say 100 bucks. That's why I was like, "Ah, dude, if you want me to be honest with you, like maybe 20, bro."
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe 30 because you're my homie.
That's No, that's good. That's good. Yeah. And it's super, super, super important that it's that the lean like model of like, okay, I'm going to validate this and sell and validate, sell. That's like very important because I, see people, and again, I'm not self-proclaiming myself expert of raising multiple rounds of capital, but it's like, I have seen people who go and raise a couple million or whatever, and they invest all this in making a product that's, in all honesty, probably amazing, probably an awesome product. But as a founder, like you have signed up for a very stressful life already, just as is. Mm-hmm. Your life's gonna be stressful. You like shouldn't make it that much more stressful by yourself have a burn of like 100,000 a month or 200,000 a month and not spending that money on sales, because your money's gonna run out and it's going to make your life hell that you don't have paying customers. To sustain that. Yeah. And then you're going to have to fundraise to save the life of your company and the paychecks of your employees. So that's why, like for us, we're always on the most aggressive path possible to have our revenue sustain our.
Well, yeah, it's like, that's runway.
Yeah. And working capital, like if you can figure out your working capital and, make it so that your money's working for you and not just working for your product. Like that is great. And now you shouldn't neglect your product. And if you do neglect your product, you'll probably experience some churn or you'll experience some things that you don't want to experience with your customer base. Right. And customer success is also a very like, don't just sell people and forget about them.
Right.
Be friends with your customers, because then they'll tell you what you want them to tell you about, their true thoughts and opinions about the product.
Yeah.
But, anyways, that's
No,
so I went on this big tangent. I was going to tell you why I wanted to be an entrepreneur and I just got caught up. I will tell you. So this, the thrill I told you about of like, selling a product and it wasn't even ready. And then we got it ready and we, sent it out there and we're like, dude, we did it. Like that feeling is like, I wake up and I'm excited to work. Like I have things that I know I need to get done. And if I don't get them done, there are people that are counting on me. There are customers, employees, investors that are counting on me. So I look forward to my day every morning and I work right now. I'm kind of the the account executive for the company because we have a small, we only have 5 employees.
Okay.
So small group. We're hoping we're raising right now because we're pretty much bootstrapped. So right now we're raising and we're hoping to grow the team quite a bit this year. But I'm like the account executive. So I'm taking meetings during the day.
Yeah.
And I do my work, my more independent work of like, okay, I need to run some financial models and I need to, you know, do some.
Build the deck.
And yeah. Yeah. A bunch of, I mean, there's just a million things you have to do as a founder. I do those things at night. And I am never, I don't have the reluctance to like do my work that I had. You know, I got my first job when I was 16.
Yeah.
Working in a kitchen. And it's like, you know, the feeling, I think everyone's felt the feeling of reluctance to work.
Yeah.
You're like, I would rather not go into work and work in a kitchen and scrub some dishes. And you can have a more fulfilling job than working in a kitchen when you're 16, right? Like you can find, but I think it's really hard to feel as fulfilled and excited about working and doing, I guess, just enjoying your work. It's hard to feel the same way that an entrepreneur feels. Just because like it is your baby, it's your company. You would do anything. It's like, so you have a daughter,
I have a daughter and a son.
Daughter and a son. It's like, I'm sure not every single thing you do is exciting. You change a diaper. Maybe that's not exciting, but I'm sure that like you know,
well, it's just part of the process. Yeah.
Yeah. When you wake up in the morning or like you get home from work and like, ultimately I'm sure there's work involved with having kids, but I'm sure you're pretty glad that they're around and to have them at home when you get home and you're like excited to go to their stuff, their wrestling matches and their like all that stuff. It's the same way with like, I think in my opinion is it's the same way with being an entrepreneur. I like discovered that once I started it is I don't always look forward to every individual thing I have to do because there are unenjoyable parts of being an entrepreneur, but I always look forward to the fact that I am an entrepreneur. I get to do, I get to, you know, this is my job. I get to have my dream job basically.
Right.
And when things work out, not only do I get to have my dream job, but there's all these awesome implications of like, you meet all these great people and you set yourself up for the future. You get, you know, you're building equity in a company that's getting more and more valuable. So anyways, I
like that, man.
Am I chasing the bag? I mean, to some degree, yes.
Sure. Why not?
It's like, why not chase it? But that's not really, you know, what it's about. When I think about like, how big do I want to build the company? It's not really a dollar amount.
I had this thought when I was younger, like in management and stuff, and people would make fun of me because I was saying it wrong though. Because it feels like what you're saying is like, you know, it's not about the money, but because I love this, but obviously the money's important.
Sure.
To me, it's like, to me, what you're trying to say when I learned how to say it was, dude, the money comes when I love what I do and when I build these building blocks. Like when everything's in place, the money just comes. Like that's a byproduct.
Yeah.
It's not the whole reason, but it's not gonna not come.
Yeah. And you're always gonna tie successes and feelings of success to money. That's normal.
Sure.
You close a big deal, that's more exciting than closing a small deal. Right? That's not criminal and that's not wrong to feel that way.
But it comes as you grow and as you love the process and you love the journey and as you love what you do, like the money just comes.
Yeah, if the purpose is the money, you run into problems, I think.
All day. If you're really chasing a bag, you're going to run into a lot of problems if it's only the money. But if it's like the journey and you're building and you want to solve problems and you're trying to help people, like money is just a byproduct that naturally comes.
If you're chasing the bag and if you don't want to like, because I do know a lot of people, there's been a lot of content out there lately about like, oh, the people that make the most money are entrepreneurs. So you get all this stuff about, oh, these jobs, you know, pay a lot. You're like, oh, well, I want to be an entrepreneur. It's like, you've got to want to be an entrepreneur. You've got
a long road.
Yeah. You can't just want to be rich. You have to want to be an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
And that means going to every trade show. And that means doing all that. Like you got to do that stuff and you have to want to do that stuff. Otherwise you won't really be in it and you won't be successful.
Yeah.
if you just want to chase the bag and just get, you want to just be richer than what you would be if you worked a 9 to 5,
yeah,
then just start to build some net worth and be an investor. Like, right, if that's what you want, be an investor, because that's really what they're, you know, like, yeah, they're trying to build wealth because they're making lots of investments in which they're not all super involved in, like with that company as an, as a VC, for example. It's like, you can't be super involved with 100 portfolio companies.
Right.
But they're going to get some returns on the ones that go big and everything.
Yeah.
So see, if that's what you want to do, become an LP or something out of VC and start contributing some money. And,
yeah,
but if you, yeah, I think certain people are wired for it and enjoy it. So like I've, you know, my wife,
yeah,
for example, I know like a lot of people, there are some entrepreneurial couples that people are like, oh yeah, yeah, so cool. You know,
like power couple,
power, yeah, couple. And that is cool, dude. Like that is a powerful couple. My wife doesn't like it. Would not want to do it.
Yeah. My wife either.
Yeah.
My wife is the same. She's, yeah, like, I could never do what you do.
Yeah. It's just,
yeah, you know, it's just different. People fine. Are just wired different. Yeah.
It's, I mean, not, that's our cup of tea. And
it's not good or bad. It's just different.
Luckily, she's, yeah, been very accommodating of
and
so, my
and supportive, I'm sure.
Yeah.
Because it takes, I mean, because she's in it just as much as you are.
Yeah. Yeah. She's absolutely in it, right? So, like, I'm like, hey, can we go in like $100,000 of debt for the company? She's like, if that's what, you know, if that's what
if we you
need
think,
to do.
If you, yeah, think we you need think to do that,
we,
yeah,
need to do that, then we can totally do that. So, like, that's great because,
yeah,
it would be hard if I had to like constantly pitch the company to her, but I've always got her support of like, you know, yeah, just if, you know, I'm
like, this is going to work. Like, this is going to make it, yeah, happen. Yeah, dude.
Yeah.
Well, bro, I really appreciate you being on the show, man.
Yeah.
Dude, absolutely. What a great conversation.
This is fun. I'm going to have to come back in a year or two or something. And
dude, I can't wait.
Give an update.
Yeah. Man.
Are there any guests that you're like actively looking for? Anyone that I would maybe be able to introduce you to or anything that I know?
No, dude, no, we're chilling, bro. Like we just have people on and you know, but I'll ask you for sure. But before I let you go though, how can everybody find you? I know you said LinkedIn, yeah, but tell everybody the
plug. Yeah. LinkedIn. If you want to read my satire, otherwise, I mean, if someone is like really intrigued in our product, then our website, localized.guide, we just bought the domain localized.ai. So that's
cool. Oh, cool.
So we're going to be transferring over to that. But yeah, if someone is interested in our product, obviously go there. But if you want to reach out to me or like we're raising right now. So if someone heard this and they're like, wow, this company is so cool, which I hope they did. Yeah. yeah, LinkedIn's a great place. Message cool, me on LinkedIn and I won't troll you in the DMs. I only troll with my posts. Will, yeah, not troll in the DMs. I'm serious in the DMs. Yeah.
Dude, good for you. All right. Thanks, bro.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.